M42. Number 5B.
I said, for the prophets, in order to convey their message, which was the message of the Christ, and no more the message of the world, they needed a new language. And they were living in a new atmosphere, surrounding, you know, in that atmosphere of disaster. First the Assyrian captivity, then the Babylonian captivity, then the longing to go back home into their country, re-establish Israel, rebuild the temple, re-establish the Jewish religion. That was a completely different inner atmosphere and mentality, a mentality of struggle, and therefore they used a completely different language. And it takes quite a time to read oneself into that language, because one has to restructure, so to say, one's symbolism that one has within oneself. In addition to it, you see, the Hebrew language only had the present tense, and they were prophesying about the future, and they had no future tense in the language. And very difficult. It's very difficult to describe something in the future when you have no future tense in your language. So, this needed a new language. When you come to the New Testament, it's absolutely a new language. Wouldn't you see, feel that? You can see very easily that the moment you read the Gospels, it's a completely different language than the prophet. It's already more easy for us, more adapted to our way of thinking. But when you come to Paul, one has first to read oneself into Paul. And one first begins to read Paul and the letters of Paul, one first has to learn the reasoning of Paul. For the first time, he reasons with you about spiritual things. The Old Testament doesn't reason with you. The Gospels don't reason with you. They state, don't they? They just state things. Here comes suddenly a man that is not trained, or that did not, was not educated back in Jerusalem, you know, but who had that culture of the Romans and of the Greeks. He knew the Greek language, he knew Latin, he knew Hebrew. I don't know if he knew Aramaic, but that doesn't matter. But he was schooled in the modern logic. See? He had that cultural contact with the Greek period, whereas that whole contact with the Greek period was anathema to the Jews, and so they didn't want to be touched by it. But here came suddenly a man who approached really Christianity from a completely different angle. It was a new paradigm for him. Therefore he wrote completely different than those four gospel writers. The gospel writers, they couldn't do anything else but relate what they have seen. They relate what Jesus was and what he did and what he said, you see, and this healing and that healing, and then he went up to the mountain, then he sat down. That's all what the Gospels talk about, how they use the language, to state things. And you come suddenly to that large part of the New Testament about Paul, and he doesn't touch on the healings that Jesus had. He doesn't touch on the life of Jesus, that he went together with his disciples through the wilderness and then sat down and then this and then that, and then came a man and he wanted to be healed. So nothing of that. And yet his whole gospel was about Jesus Christ. How can you suddenly write more, as many pages or more pages about the same phenomena without touching in the practically in the least the symbolism, the language of the gospel. What did he do? He could see that behind Jesus was a principle. And he could see that behind Jesus was a principle that acted according to certain laws. And that actually what was necessary is to find out those laws. And not the stories. To present the stories. So he reasoned from beginning to end. Have you ever read Paul? Huh? The letters of Paul? It's all reasoning. Huh? And only very seldom he hints to Jesus. Much more does he hint to the Old Testament. And showing, look here, there is a great law flowing right through the Old Testament, bringing us up to the time of Jesus, to the time of Paul, and showing this is not something new, this is just the continuous development of what has going on all through the Old Testament. So when one begins to investigate Paul's letters, I needed a few months to get to read myself into it. Because I came right out at that time of studying the prophets, and I had done those 2-3 years on the prophets, and then from there jumped into Paul's letters. I had a difficult time to read myself into it. My ears were so used to the tonality of the Christ, you know, in the prophets. Always that terrific power coming down, coming to Israel, doing something in Israel, overturning and overturning in Israel. And then suddenly you come to this crystal clear reasoning, yes, because this is so, therefore the next thing is this, and that leads you to that. And so, it's a different way of approach. Why did I say that? I came somehow from that arc, huh? Which means, see, that one needs somehow a completely different consciousness, language consciousness, so to say, to read the Old Testament. If one reads the Old Testament with English, it doesn't make sense. Because, see again, logic was unknown to the Hebrews. Logic was unknown. We can hardly think that logic was unknown, that there was once mankind that did not reason logically. But it's not very long ago that one found out some kind of logic. This is not something that is innate in mankind, and that right when he came down from the trees, he began to think things out logically. He didn't. And the Israelites were the ones that perhaps in the Western world were the last ones to accept logic. The last ones. Therefore, we cannot read with our logical mind the Old Testament. Doesn't fit, you see? Doesn't fit. Because like we had it with killing, huh? The other hour, huh? We have to see what killing means. Killing does not mean that what we, 3,000 years later, in our rational age, call killing. That's the difficulty. Can you see that? That we take our present language and the meaning of our present language and put it right into the Bible and think we can understand the Bible. And that's why so many intelligent people drop the Bible. Because it doesn't make sense. Because they are not aware that they first would have to learn a new language. The moment one can show them and say, look here, you have to learn a new language. You can't read a book that is written in Chinese, you can't read that with your English knowledge. It doesn't work. And so it is here. So here we had the ark, was a wonderful symbol that ark to us. We laugh about it. How could they think that dear God Almighty is in the ark? And that if Israel doesn't have the ark being dragged along, they took it, you know, into every battle. And if the ark was not there, they were not secure. They felt they are losing the battle because the Lord God was not with them. We think this is ridiculous. For them it was not ridiculous because they had a different concept of it. For them it was just a symbol for what we call principle. We would also feel insecure to go into a battle without the consciousness of principle, wouldn't we? That's just the point, that we feel we should approach a battle with a consciousness of principle. Yes, so this was a side remark, an unexpected one, but a necessary one when you study the Bible. And you feel now how tonality is important. See, so if we really culture our tonality, we just sense when what interpretation is right. Yeah. Because, yes?
Is that how, when you said I had to read myself into it, is that your method?
Oh.
Clearing your consciousness, or how do you figure out?
It may be that my English expression may not be right. I must ask you, is that the right expression when you say I had to read myself into it? Does that mean that I had first to read and read until I felt that I was at one with the subject? Is that an expression, to read into it? Say, if you take up suddenly a textbook of a completely different subject in which you are not familiar with, they suddenly would have to take up a textbook on geology and you don't know anything about geology. Don't you say, I had first to read myself into it, or to read, what do you call it?
Custom myself to it.
Or custom myself to it. Yeah. Well, that was my meaning when I said that, that I had first to read over and over and begin to learn to know how they write, so that when I read it, I began much more to have a feeling in which way they express themselves, what kind of a method they use to present the subject. That's what I meant. I had first to read myself into it, acquaint myself with it, acquaint with the way it is presented. Yeah. So you read and read various times over it until you finally feel, oh, now I understand the language. When you understand the language, you only begin then to ask, now what does it mean? Yeah. When you come to mind as life, how was that vision expressed now here, that vision of the parent mind that had conceived of the right idea, how is it expressed here now as life? What is the story here? How is life brought out, that the vision must be life, that the vision must be exalted, that the vision must be spontaneous? Huh? Yes? Yes, Louise?
That it must be individualized here, and Samuel says that Saul would be king, so that would, at this point, be the
individualization
of that life, although it wasn't
just
Saul, was not really the true
end. Yeah, well, yes, yes. What did you find in this story, this terrific story of life, that the idea of mind has the nature of life, a nature of spontaneity. You really have here the serendipity of an idea. It's really shown how Saul went really on a serendipity trip. He went out to find something, to search something, to find it, what he was seeking, and he found something completely different. He found something, but not that which he was seeking. He found something much more beautiful, because he went out to find the lost asses. I'm afraid to pronounce that term. And in the first go, he didn't find them, but he found his kingship. He found something much bigger. Isn't that life? Isn't that the newness of life, the spontaneity of life, the serendipity of life, which shows that the idea of mind as life always shows, once an idea is born out of divine mind and not of the human mind, it will always lead us to an exalted and ever more exalted state of consciousness. It will not just lead us there where we humanly are trying to seek something which we humanly desire. But that, you see, that's the meaning of serendipity, really, that you try to find something which you are seeking, and then suddenly you are aware that you are sidetracked to something completely different, and out of that other sidetrack or that other way, something much more, much bigger begins to individualize itself. And so, instead of finding the asses, he found Samuel. And Samuel said, "I make you king." So we can see as life that we can expect that the idea of mind will give us, provide for us something much higher than what we ever dreamt of. And that's true. I know it. I have experienced it in the line of science many times. Your thought goes along a line of the divine mind, not knowing where it leads to, and suddenly you find something that is so big, so unexpected. So unexpected. You see, life is the unexpectedness of life, and something happens and something completely new reveals itself, and something one hasn't expected. These stories are true. These are not tales. These stories are true for us today. We go to truth. What happened in truth? Yes?
That's when Saul was anointed. And I have a little quote here. He was turned into another man.
Yes? Yeah?
So this light of mine is made manifest as the true manhood and only king.
Yes? That's what happened here.
Let me ask a question here. This point that starts from the mind, spirit, soul, and the coming forth of Samuel. But at the point when you go from soul to principle, Samuel apparently is still a child, isn't he? When he was called in principle, when he was called, he was still a child. And yet, apparently, there was a need for a king then. And so, then Saul comes into the picture and was anointed king. And it's as though when you're seeing these ideas, that there's no time element. It didn't have to wait until Samuel was grown or David appeared. But that the idea is individualized, regardless of any time or age sense.
Yes, yes. One must never put any time sense into the Bible stories. Huh? That from one story to the next story, there is a certain time sense in it, and between there is a year or 2 years or 2 days or so. They are. It's just a collection of symbolism in order to bring out a present metaphysical idea. But that's the way they had to write it. Yeah. So here in Mind as Truth, we begin to realize that idea gives us our true manhood. We become king, and it says it became captain over his inheritance. We become heir of that divine mind, and we take in the whole inheritance, and make ourselves king unto God. Yeah, that's the vision. You see, it was still a vision, because as we can see afterwards, that until that vision does not go through the purification of spirit and soul, that it does not materialize itself. So at the point of principle, Saul was killed as king and David became king. So also this, you see, you could say, historically you could say, but if Hannah had really a vision, and that Samuel really had a vision, why did he on earth choose Saul, who afterwards didn't make the grade? So apparently he wasn't a really good prophet if he did choose the wrong man. You see, that's the way we can reason, but that's human reasoning. That's not the way these people reason. They don't reason. That's why it's quite good, say, to become a bit acquainted with the way myths have been written. See, the stories of myths, they don't have a time sense in it. And we discard myths, you see. Oh, that's just myth, you know. Yes, we can discard it, because at that time they had no logic. But the things they said were true. You see? The things they said were already very true. And the Bible just has taken those myths and have put them so together, like the creation myth, that it brought some order in it. Now, today we come and say, well, if a story is not presented in a logical way, it's therefore illogical and therefore not scientific, and that's what we can say. But we must not forget in which age they were written. And the age in which they were, the mythical age, you see, is an age where people had no sense of time. Sense of time only came in very late into human consciousness. You see, isn't it funny? We grow up here in the West with a sense of time and space and accept this is the most natural thing. Even those people who were living in the caves, the cavemen and so on, they must have as naturally the same sense, a time sense and a space sense. They didn't. They didn't. See, this is very new. Yes?
Spengler points out in his study that the time sense and space sense are indigenous to Western civilization, of all civilizations that have been fractured. And it comes into really full-fledged expression around the 15th or 16th century.
Yeah, yes.
It was started really just before Newton.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's a very recent thing.
How very recent?
And most languages, ancient languages, and even the old versions of the modern languages don't have ways of expressing this time sense.
No. Yeah. You see? Yeah, absolutely. You see, we forget that the space sense came around about 1500. You see, but with Leonardo da Vinci, the perspective with Galilei, the telescope. With the discovery of America, going around the Magellan Strait and discovering West Indies and so on, around about that time, you had really the first sense of space. You know that very well when you look at pictures before that time, say if they drew a city or so, there is no space in it. It's flat. There is no perspective. The perspective was, I have to be careful now, I have an art teacher here, was more or less invented. Some put it on Leonardo da Vinci, some on a predecessor about that time. Let's say at the end of the 15th century or so.
He actually made the first diagram.
Yes. And in literature, you see, in literature, the first description of space is around that time, too, by a man whose name I have forgotten. He is the first one who described how he climbed up on a mountain and described space, what he saw. See, we forget that people didn't have that sense. No time sense. We can hardly think that people didn't have a time sense when they had the sun rising and going down, that makes a day, huh? But they didn't have the consciousness of time. Therefore, in the myth, everything happens parallel, or that which happened afterwards is written before. There is no order in time in the myth. Naturally, we come now with science to the same point, because we also do away with time and space. You see? And the intervening period is, so to say, a period where we have to think out, and logically to think out why there is no space and no time, why there is only isness. So at the beginning and at the end are similar phenomena. The myth and the science have similar phenomena, namely a non-dualistic logic. They have a one valid logic in which there is no time and no space. Yeah? So, in reading the Bible, we have to remember that. Yes, Rosemary?
You know, I also would like to make a point here about the logic, because there is also awareness today more and more that there is a psychological logic and a scientific logic.
Yeah.
Let's say these prophets, they all reasoned exceedingly well, but always with the psychological, from the psychological point
yeah.
of view.
Yeah. Which I don't know exactly if that is the same as the...
I'm always accused of being psychologically logical.
I guess a woman will be that way. Or but it's really the mythical logic, you see. Yeah? Okay.